Good Saturday morning, Nashville. Kamlin Knezovic here on ESPN 102.5, 106.3, the game Nashville app. Man, there's a lot going on this weekend in the sporting world. Can't wait to break it all down here. I'm Elijah Campbell. No Michelle today. Michelle with a DNP. But we do have the one and only Jared Papa Cass Cassidy behind the glass. Back from a little mini vacation, Jared is. Had a nice little week off. His son turned one. Cal is 1 year old. So little mini Cass is now crawling around here, 1 year old.
Congrats.
Congrats to Cal. Happy late birthday, Cal. But Jared and I are going to be here for the next 2 hours to break everything down. And Jared, it's nice to have you back. Doing the double duty, the co-hosting, also being behind the producer glass. It's not for the faint of heart. It's for the ultra-talented at multitasking, and Jared was born for this moment.
I have learned from the best and many people.
once you figure out the board, everything else kind of comes naturally. But you got your Red Sox hat on right now. You're the Boston sports fan of the station, and man, that's a good place to start, because what we saw last night in Boston, that was a hell of a game four. I mean, we finally got a game that was going to be down to the wire, and it still ended up being a 10-point game. This is like the fourth game of the series. All four games have been double digits, but realistically, these teams aren't more than 6 points better than each other on any given night, in my opinion. Things kind of just happened at the end. Last night, there were some garbage time points at the end where the Warriors were able to make it 10, but they're not 10 points better, you know, than the Boston Celtics.
Right.
But, man, when Steph Curry shoots like that and scores 43 points on 26 shots, you kind of have to hand it to him. That's a game that you can play as great defensively as they did and still lose.
Yeah, they did. I mean, we talked a little bit before. I thought they played it great, tremendously on defense. I just thought that on offense, they really just couldn't get a rhythm. It seemed like they were either one or two passes behind or forward. Tough game, but 2-2. Now you got a best of three, so shift back to the Bay now. Celtics have played good on the road, so that is a positive sign.
Especially following a loss. They're 7-0 in the postseason. Yep. After a loss. I think they're the only to know. The Warriors haven't either. Have lost back-to-back games in the postseason.
Yeah, crazy that they're in the finals together.
It is, yeah. And it makes a ton of sense, too. The Celtics play evenly with a lot of teams. You know, like I was thinking about this on the car ride home yesterday, that if the Celtics do win, say they win this series in seven, right, then they would have gone through the entire postseason only being about four games above 500.
Yeah, that's
technically
wild.
If you take out that first series, they swept the Nets.
Right.
But the last three series, they'd be a combined three games over 500. But that's enough to win. That's all that matters. It would be enough to win. Like the Celtics have been an interesting team, but defensively, I thought they did as well as you could do on Golden State. Like, Golden State only put up 107 points. It's not like Golden State's putting up an offensive clinic in this series. I mean, outside of Steph Curry doing what he did in the last few minutes of the game, where he's hitting these contested fall-away threes, and every time the Celtics were able to get up back 5-6 points, it seemed like Curry or Thompson would end up hitting a three, hitting a shot, and sparking a little bit of a comeback.
Yeah, it was hard. It's kind of hard to stop Curry. You know, you can only hope to contain him, but mm-hmm. when you don't contain him and he scores 43 points and it looks like it's with ease, that's not a good sign. Yeah, the two of them, Clay, Curry, both of them just hitting shots when they needed to. Absolutely. But the defense on both of them, I thought at times, was great. Thought, you know, and even if the Celtics had a mismatch, they were pretty quick to move around people. You know, Robert Williams just playing like a tree down there. I mean, it's kind of wild to see him do that.
He's the small ball killer. Like the thing with Boston, I think, that really won them game three was they have this thing figured out where if you play lineups with two traditional bigs, you know, because Grant Williams is maybe not a center, but he's a really good small ball fight. Four to match with, or Al Horford. Like when they start the game with Al Horford at the four and Robert Williams at the five, they've been really, really good in terms of neutralizing Golden State's like small ball attack, because they just grab rebounds too. It's like in game three, it wasn't like the Celtics were making every three they shot, or they weren't putting on some kind of offensive clinic. In game three, they only had about an effective field goal shooting of 55.6, which was lower than what the Warriors had. But about 55, 60% of the time, you have better effective field goal shooting in the NBA, you're going to win the game. But they grabbed 37.5% of their misses, and Golden State only grabbed 15.8% of their misses in game three. The clear factor was Robert Williams and Al Horford creating second chances. And even though the Warriors played fantastic defensively, it's much harder to play defense when the possession is now becoming a minute-long possession because they milked it down, got a shot off, missed it, and then grabbed another rebound and reset the shot clock. Right. And last night, it was completely different. Like, the Warriors won the rebounding battle significantly. They grabbed 34% of their misses, and they did it in small ball lineups. They did it without having to play Kevon Looney a ton more minutes. Like, he played 28 minutes, but you got a lot of offensive rebounds out of Andrew Wiggins.
Yeah.
Andrew Wiggins was one that brought the unsung hero last night. Like, Clay was the second leading scorer, but if Andrew Wiggins doesn't go off for 17 and 16 rebounds, they don't win that game. Like, Andrew Wiggins got bullied on the boards in game three. Him and Draymond Green got bullied on the boards. They don't want to play in lineups where you can't go small. It's their death lineup. That's what they've done all year. And they started off last night with Looney on the bench and Otto Porter Jr. coming in to make Draymond play at the five, and they only got about 14 minutes out of Otto Porter Jr. But Andrew Wiggins stepped up, man. That's something they've needed out of him to just be the Harrison Barnes, and he was definitely that in terms of just doing what needed to be done. Not enough, I think, is being made about his rebounding efforts, especially in the last, 5 minutes of that game, for them to be able to pull that off.
Yeah, another thing, too, is, though, that maybe Wiggins didn't have that if Jordan Poole didn't get those three quick fouls, too.
Yeah, that's true, because Jordan Poole's playing great in those minutes.
Yeah, because that forced their hand, too, is to switch around their lineup, because when he got that third foul, they had no choice to pull him out.
Like, that's the versatility that he was able to show last night is, A, why they traded for him. Because you could buy low, because Minnesota gave up on him. A lot of teams in the NBA gave up on Andrew Wiggins, and rightfully so, because he definitely underachieved at many points of his career. But last night, he hit a couple threes in the first half when it looked like, I thought, Boston was going to pull away. Because Boston was up one at the end of the first quarter, but they were up maybe like 6-7 points early on, and it kind of felt like it did at the beginning of game three, where they're going to get a big cushion, and it's going to take a lot for the Warriors to come back. Like, I don't know, a 7-point possession to help get you back in the game. There's a whole lot of that went down in that first quarter. But Andrew Wiggins, I think both those threes he hit were in that first quarter to, like, bring them back into the game.
Yeah, it was kind of wild. It was a lot of flip-flopping, not necessarily with the lead, but it seemed like the momentum during that game just went from, like, one team straight to the other. I mean, obviously, but, like, the Warriors, I wouldn't say that they, like, shot the ball extremely well. I mean, Curry shot the ball good.
Yeah.
But, I mean,
he didn't start off shooting well, though. I think he missed his first three three-pointers.
Right.
And they kinda wasted some possessions early just trying to get him going. But if you take away those three, he was 7 for his last 11.
Right, and he kind of shot himself out of that funk, too. So those numbers will be inflated a little bit just because he was trying to get that shot feeling back.
Yeah, and I don't really blame the Celtics defense, because, like, we have the game on in the studio right now, like the replays of it, and a lot of these threes, man, when you go back and watch, like the last one that Steph hit where he stops, he's like in transition, stops at the three-point line, kind of pump fakes, Derek White bites the pump fake but then recovers really well and still has not just his hand. If you're watching on our stream presented by the Law Office of Amanda Gentry, if you look at the stream, it's not like he just has, like, his hand in his face. He had almost his armpit in his face. Like, I mean, it was still really well covered, and Steph Curry still hits it. Like, you can play great defense on this team, and sometimes when Steph Curry is playing like that, then it's hard to stop. Like, it's impossible. It's almost – there's nothing you can do, because then we saw another play, Jared, when we were before the show started, where Robert Williams has gotten one-on-one. He got the switch on Steph Curry, which, if you're the Celtics, you'll live with this, because Robert Williams is a great defender, and you will live with the result. But Robert Williams moves up on Steph, and Steph just kind of goes around him, because if he gives him that space, then Steph's just going to shoot a three. So what else can you do? You have to live off your help defense, and the Celtics are really great at that. But when Steph Curry figures it out late in the game, you almost kind of just have to hope the shots he throws up, he misses.
Right. They're showing replays of the the fourth quarter and showing Tatum missing those couple of key shots down there at the end of them.
Mm-hmm.
That hurt him a pretty good amount, too. The turnovers, too, is another thing.
Tatum had six.
Yeah. He had a lot. It seemed like both teams, though, it was like kind of sloppy there around the second quarter and mm-hmm. I guess mid-third quarter is what it would have been.
Because the Warriors got careless. Yeah, they go through stretches of games, and they have all playoffs long where they just get insanely careless with the basketball.
Yeah, it seemed like it was just like touching somebody's hands, and then it was going off, and then somebody else would grab it, pass it, make a bucket, and it would do the same thing like three mm-hmm. times. Just not enough ball control on there, but Celtics just couldn't get anything going offensively there towards the end either. I mean, 17-3 to end that game definitely didn't help them.
That's been the theme of the series, too. These teams are tight until one team goes on a run that is a backbreaker. And obviously, 17-3 in the last, 3.5 minutes of this game? Because the Celtics, with under four, were up four. Yep. And then the 17-3 run for the Warriors was basically the kiss of death in this game. And if you watch some of those possessions, too, at the very end, when they're not turning the ball over, they're still getting good shots, and they just missed them. I mean, and that's the worst cliche in the NBA is it's a make-or-miss league. And last night, in the last little bit, it became that, whenever they actually were able to salvage some possessions. But another unsung hero, too, that Draymond Green offensively has been putrid at times. But last night, he made his money defensively by either stripping Tatum or taking away backdoor passes. Like, if you watch some of those, the offensive sets that the Celtics were running at the end of that game, a lot of it, they were trying to go create things for backdoor cuts for layups, and Draymond Green's denying passes, and you're not getting that pass over there. And Draymond Green's getting his hand in passing lanes, and he was able to disrupt the offense just as well as anybody can as a great on-ball defender. Draymond Green was fantastic off-ball last night, and that was a huge reason that the result was the way it was.
Right, and he had that bad charge block call right mm-hmm. there in the first when he got those two quick fouls.
Very quick.
And I thought that was going to be a momentum changer for the whole game, almost mm-hmm. the entire series right there, because if the Celtics or the crowd or whoever, and they're making a huge deal on the crowd, but that happens in every NBA
arena. It's the NBA Finals, man. Yeah, absolutely. It's hostile.
Matter.
Yeah, it's supposed to be hostile. It's the NBA Finals. You have to have some kind of home court advantage.
Right. They are trying to play a game, and if you show that, you are showing that they are winning, and they are going to give it to you even worse.
As they should. Yeah. If I was a Boston fan, I heard the Klay Thompson crybaby speech at the end of Game 3. Oh, very classy, Boston. Very classy. It's like, no one's threatening to kill your family or whatever, dude. Like, sure, like some things over the line, whatever. But you're a professional. Like, go in there and just win the game. And they to their credit, last night, because it was getting raucous. Whenever the Celtics got back up four with about 4 minutes left or a little under, it did kind of feel like they might have had a stranglehold on this game, and
didn't turn out that way.
Incredible, but lots to go down in that series. It's tied up at two, going back to the Bay. We'll break that down. Tennessee baseball, too. Are we seeing a meltdown in front of our very eyes? Is the thing that gave them their edge all year the one thing that can end their season prematurely? We'll discuss all that and more as you listen to Campbell and Knezovic right here on ESPN 102.5, 106.3, The Game, and The Game Nashville app. I know the Warriors love California because that's home, and they are going back to California. Sorry, a Monday night for Game 5. Series tied at 2. Will Jared's beloved Boston Celtics move to 8-0 following losses in the NBA playoffs this year? That's the question right now. And Jared, like, as an avid Celtics fan, you've watched the Celtics more than anybody here. And you've seen how good they've been bouncing back from losses and how good of an adjustment team they are. I mean, Ime Udoka has to have all the credit in the world for being able to take the adversity they faced in these playoffs and be able to run with it. I mean, just the fact that they were down 3-2 in that series against Milwaukee in Game 6 on the road, the defending champions, and pulling out a win right there because the defense was so smothering. And if there's any way to slow down Giannis Antetokounmpo, they found a way to at least slow him down enough to win two games back-to-back when you absolutely needed it to save your season. I still feel like the Celtics are mentally for me, the favorites to win the series because of how good they are defensively.
I agree.
And I think it's going to take games like Steph Curry scoring 40 for them to win. Same thing with like with Miami. I felt like Miami only had shots to win more than one game that series if Jimmy Butler was putting up about 40 points because that's how good the Celtics are defensively. How do you feel about that? Because I know like you've seen this team a lot.
Right. So with the Heat, the other thing too, I think a big impact for them was with the without Tyler Hero. Being able to back up Jimmy Butler when Jimmy Butler couldn't go for, let's say, 40 points or so.
Mm-hmm.
Now, going back to the Bucks series, the Bucks was a huge test. Let's take out the Nets because that was four games. And
they buzzsawed them.
Right, yeah. And the Nets just don't – they don't even know what planet they're on. So
they lost that. The Nets lost that series after game one. They had their chance in game one, and then once that didn't go their way, it all went downhill.
Yeah, it was pretty rough to watch, but also awesome at the same time. So the Bucks series in general, I mean, Giannis is just a force in the NBA. And, you know, him, a big thing with, you know, Chris Middleton, like, being gone and stuff.
That hurt, yeah.
Big deal for them, too. I don't know, man. The Celtics have played great defense since – I guess the last half of the season, ever since the All-Star break, really, they've been a pretty tremendous defensive team with some, you know, ebbs and flows in between, but for the most part have been very consistent on defense. I think that that's what's going to win a championship. I mean, it's the old cliche, right? Defense wins championships and football and whatever. You can
whatever
go
sport
across sports with it.
Offense sells the tickets. Defense wins the championships.
Yeah. True. But if you can shut down somebody that is a prolific scorer like Steph Curry and Klay Thompson and Draymond, when the three of them are the Warriors, if you can hold them to, you know, like last night, giving 43 to Steph is not great. But you can live with that if you can keep down Klay Thompson and Draymond.
If Klay was doing what he was doing in game two, I know the Warriors won game two, but they didn't win game two because they were that great offensively. Steph was great. Klay was awful. Jordan Poole was good for like a 7-minute stretch that helped them extend what was a small lead into an insurmountable lead. He was great in that stretch. But for the most part in game two, it wasn't like the Warriors were setting the world on fire offensively. The Celtics clamped him down. If the Celtics can't score, which it's duh, if they can't score, they can't win. But like they go through stretches sometimes where offensively they do get so dry, you know, and maybe they don't win game one if they don't score 41 points in the fourth quarter because they were knocking down a lot of shots, which they generated. But like the two games they've lost in this series, they didn't score over 100 points. The Warriors I've been pretty consistent. Game one, the Warriors scored 108. Game two, 107. Game three, 100. Last night, 107. They're going to consistently get you anywhere from 100 to 108 points. Doesn't sound like an insurmountable amount of points to be able to score from. But that's where the Warriors defensively have done a really good job also responding. I talked about Ime Udoka being the king of the adjustment in the NBA playoffs so far. But
right.
What the Warriors figured out last night in that last little bit where anytime Jason Tatum got a foot in the paint, Draymond Green is slapping at the ball. And sometimes those are fouls. Sometimes you get the ball clean last night and you knock it loose. And sometimes you just get lucky with them missing open shots. Marcus Smart missing that corner three. I mean, he was wide open.
Yeah, that was tough.
The Celtics offense generated a really good look, and he just missed a wide open shot. The Celtics have to be able to shoot the ball so well. And like I thought last night they did a little better at getting shots near the rim. Whereas in the first two games of the series, the Celtics shot 14 shots at the rim because they almost got spoiled by themselves because they hit so many threes in game one.
Yeah, it was very perimeter-oriented that game. But this game last night seemed like they were trying to drive to the basket a little bit more, try to work the paint, try to get people off of their assignments or where they're supposed to be at that time. It just seems like some of the shots couldn't go down.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the only thing is that the entire season that's been happening on offense – watching a lot of those games, and we've talked about it plenty of times, and I've told you, I was like, man, are they ever going to get it together? Because it's just like you just can't keep going at a pace where you have these scoring abilities all around that ball, but you're trying to highlight one-on-one, but somehow some mistake goes wrong and it costs that whole play to break down. But in the first two games, I mean, I thought that the offense looked great. I do think that last night the offense looked really rough, whereas in game three, if seemed like the offense shined, but the defense was even better than the offense in game three.
Yeah. The defense is what won them that game in game three. Right. And it could have won them the game last night. But you have to be able to knock down those shots that are presented late in the game. And a lot of it was – another thing, too, is like the corner three is a significant spot in this series because Al Horford killed them on the corner, on the baseline, absolutely murdered them in game one. And whenever the Celtics do go off offensively, it's getting those shots and the Warriors having to live with Al Horford taking an open jumper.
Right.
And last night they missed all of their corner threes that are like right at the dead corner. They only shot about three of them. They missed all three of them. And a lot of this, too, like I'll credit the Celtics this. I did go back and check the shot chart. They did get about seven or eight shots at or near the rim, whereas that's almost half of what they got in those first two games in general. And then even outside, maybe like seven, eight footers, they shot a lot more. They just missed a ton of them, man. And it's not like – I know Kevon Looney's a really good defensive big man, but you can't shoot under – 45 or under 46% from two in each quarter. They did not have a quarter last night in which they made more than 46% of their 2-point shots.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. He played really well though last night, I thought, but except for shooting the ball, his defense to me seemed to shine a little bit more last night.
The first half he was fantastic. Yeah. I mean, he was getting in passing lanes, got some steals last night too, where Steph Curry bring the ball past half court and he just pressured him, which is what you have to do, especially if he's going to shoot 14 threes and make seven of them and right. go off like that.
And that's something you don't plan for either.
Yeah.
You know, you don't plan for him to be able to steal the ball from somebody, you know, like Jason Tatum or, you know.
Especially one-on-one with Brown. Stuff. Yeah. Like in the finals, like the Raptors had to double him almost the second he came across half court. And then you live with a 3-on-2 and hopefully the supporting cast doesn't kill you like that. But if you can still put one man on Steph as he crosses half court, then maybe you can slow him down for a little bit, which is what they did in the first half. It just didn't work because Steph Curry did what legends do, and that's exactly what he is. We can finally put to bed, I think, the silly notion that he doesn't play well in the finals, isn't a finals player, doesn't play well in the finals. I think last night that's his second 40-plus point game in the finals in his career, and he willed them back when they were staring down the barrel of a 3-1 deficit to be able to make this a series going back to California.
Right, yeah, he was definitely cooking last night.
Yeah.
The chef was at work.
And another thing, what makes this team the Warriors is when Draymond Green is in the game and useful, especially defensively. We talked about it earlier. Draymond Green getting his hands in passing lanes, being able to strip Jason Tatum once he got into the paint. One of the reasons why the Celtics, A, only shot 8 twos in the fourth quarter, and B, one of the reasons they only made 3 of those 2-point shots, a lot of which we're trying to get to around the rim. Draymond was a big part of that. Draymond's a big part of this team. And in 2016, when he kicked LeBron where the sun didn't shine, then he got kicked out. Kicked out of that game, suspended the next game. And you can point to that as to why the Warriors did not become the 2016 NBA Finals champions. They had a historic regular season. The Tennessee Vols baseball team had a historic regular season at 56-7. They've had a historic playoff run. But because they can't keep their cool, it's going to cost them, just like it cost the Golden State Warriors in 2016. We'll discuss that on the other side. It's Justin Campbell and Knezovic right here on ESPN, 102.5, 106.3 the game Nashville app. Ah, yes. A little bit of sabotaging going on. It's what Draymond Green did to the Warriors finals run in 2016 when they go up 3-1, but he kicks LeBron in the groin. And then get suspended for the next game. And that was the turning point in the series. Because the Warriors could have easily closed out the Cavs in that game five. But without Draymond's defensive presence, it was easy for LeBron and Kyrie to go for 40 points apiece and steal that game on the road. We all know what happens next. The Cavs go back to Cleveland, blow out the Warriors in the second half, force a game seven, which is, in my opinion, the most influential basketball game of the 21st century. That year, you can make a case that the game six against the Thunder for the Warriors might have also pushed over a few dominoes that wouldn't have been pushed if that game would have gone a little differently. But last night, with the Tennessee Volunteers having being 56-7, having game one against Notre Dame in the Super Regional at their home stadium, at Lindsey Nelson Stadium, Drew Gilbert, who embodies this Tennessee baseball team perfectly. He's good. He's dominant. He'll let you know that he is dominant. He might be the best bat on a team that has the best bats, a team that could lead the country in batting average and ERA and home runs. He could be the best player. I think you make a good case he's the best player on this team.
For sure.
Best player on the best team in college baseball. Runs his mouth. Gets thrown out of a game down 5-1. And now Tennessee is looking down the barrel of underachieving a historic regular season and not even getting to the College World Series because now Drew Gilbert is suspended for game two today. Drew Gilbert might have cost his team that chance. Now, a lot went wrong yesterday. I cited yesterday on Darren Donick and Chase that Tennessee's pitching is going to be the reason that Notre Dame doesn't get close to winning a game. Well, when Drew Gilbert got ejected, they were down 5-1 because they couldn't pitch. Notre Dame was hitting Tennessee's pitching. Chase Dolander's on the mound today, the SEC pitcher of the year, and they're going to look to have him not give up 5 runs in the first 3 innings. But without Drew Gilbert, it is going to be significantly tougher for them to win this game. And when I saw that yesterday, when he has been giving ample warning throughout the game to ease up on the verbal abuse, and then he had one bad call prompts him to turn around and drop some F-bombs at an umpire, he was asking for an ejection, and he got what he asked for. But I don't think he asked for costing his team a chance at capping off a very special season and underachieving. So when I saw that, all I could think about was Draymond Green not being able to control himself in game 4 of the NBA Finals in 2016. Drew Gilbert couldn't control himself and hold his composure for one bad call to be able to keep himself in the game for his team.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. Now, I can see where people are angry because of where the strike was.
It was a bad call. The umpire's call was brutal.
100%. That is the wrong call in that situation. But if the ref, ump, whatever, blue, whatever you want to call them, zebras, whatever they tell you, if they give you a warning and tell you that you need to keep it in your dugout to your players, your coaches, whoever you want, the water guy, whatever's going in there, that's where it belongs. It shouldn't come back out onto the field. They have a job to do. It was the wrong call. There have been millions upon millions of wrong calls across sports since the beginning of time.
That ain't going away.
It's not going to change. It's going to happen. It's called the human element. People want to replace them with robots. Well, machines make mistakes too sometimes too, guys. So
I could totally see Tony Vitello getting a chest bumping a machine, right. A robot. Long for the days that we're going to get robot umps and somebody's going to get mad at a call and argue with a computer. It's going to happen. If that ever becomes a thing and we start automating the home plate umpire position, there are going to be people arguing with computers and it's going to look ridiculous. But that's where we're going. That's where we're heading.
Yeah, because somebody on the other end of that camera sees them. So Tony Vitello would definitely let his point be known.
Yes.
But it was an unexcusable call. It should have never happened. Like I said, especially now because you put your team in such a difficult circumstance now. You have to win 2 games back-to-back Saturday and Sunday to give your chance to go to the College World Series. You can't do that if you are one of the key pieces to the puzzle in that baseball program for the last couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
You are a superstar on that team, so to say. Mm-hmm. And you could end up costing your team. It's just it's a bad look for the brand, as people would say.
It is. And here's the thing. I don't have a problem with Tennessee baseball's brand. I understand what they're trying to accomplish. And honestly, I think it's great for college baseball because more people have been talking about this team than any Tennessee baseball team of all time.
For sure, ever.
Yeah, because they're cocky, because they're brash, because they're just a lot of these things, they are good for the game. However, when that's your reputation, and you know it's your reputation, and you still can't get out of your own way, it's going to cost you a chance to be a national champion. Like, that's the thing. Like, you can't do what you do. You can't talk that kind of trash, get ejected from a lot of games in the regular season if you're like Tony Vitello or the Anderson, the pitching coach, who got himself ejected for coming out of the dugout when you know that's what's going to happen. This isn't his first rodeo either. Like, this isn't the coaching staff's first rodeo in terms of getting ejected for arguing calls. Let Vitello manage it. Let him go out there by himself, because you know the millisecond you go out there and follow him like a puppy dog, you're going to get tossed out too. You know that. You're not an idiot. These aren't idiots. These guys aren't dumb. But you have to be able to control your emotions. And I get that's what you play. That's the edge you play with. That is the energy that has made you as good as you are. I get that. But at the same time, man, these are the most important games. You need your best player. If you're Drew Gilbert, it's not worth getting kicked out of the game to tell the ump how you feel. It really isn't. Right. And it could be what costs them. No one feels bad for Draymond Green when he gets kicked out for being an idiot in games. No one feels bad. Quite the opposite. He gets roasted more so than anybody, and rightfully so, because his reputation precedes him. Tennessee baseball's reputation is preceding them right now. So no one's going to cry tears for Drew Gilbert or Tony Vitello or this team. Now they are behind the eight ball. And if you're a true champion, you dig out of this hole. But man, I saw that yesterday and it's like, dude, not over that.
Right.
A ball strike call in the third inning after you have had ample warning is not a way to cost your team that game.
The being down, what, 5 runs at the time, I believe is what it was. They were down 8-2 or 8-3 at that point?
They were down, I think it was like 5-1.
Okay,
5-1. Because that was still early in the game. Sorry. Yeah, and Tennessee, to their credit, they made it a lot interesting too, because Notre Dame got up big and they were able to at least come back. Yeah, they're never out of it because they're that kind of team.
Right, and they have the weapons to dig themselves out of the hole. But if you're missing the biggest weapon that you have, like let's take the Titans last year. You take away A.J. Brown. What does that season look like? That's essentially what you're doing with this team right here, is that you're taking one of the key ingredients in the soup and you're taking it out. Mm-hmm. And now you're going to have to make up for that. And now you already have a little chip on your shoulder. So you could go one or two ways, right? Mm-hmm. You could see them use this, or it could work against them. And we could see it just be their downfall and the demise of a great season comes to an end before it even really gets going, right?
It would be such a shame. This team was so good. We talked on Darren Nonick and Chase yesterday. We're going through the list of teams that are playing in Super Regionals right now, and I couldn't convince myself that one of those teams could take on Tennessee. I really couldn't. And the question's like, are they going to lose a game before they get to the final series in the College World Series? But they might not get to that point because they can't keep their emotions in check. And like, yes, I know that the ejection's not what 100% costs in the game. Giving up 5 runs early is probably a bigger culprit in that game than Drew Gilbert getting ejected. But when you're at Tennessee, you understand that you can get down. And they've been down plenty of times this season. And they erase big deficits, kind of like the Golden State Warriors can. They can get down. And they can face big deficits, but you have the big guns offensively to get you back in any game you play in. If you can keep your stuff together, if you can just control your emotions for the time being to get yourself back in that game, they couldn't do it. Drew Gilbert, Draymond Green on his team yesterday. And no one's going to shed any tears for that program.
Nope. The refs certainly don't care.
No.
And if that's what his intent was, is to cause a big fuss about, you know, arguing that, I get, look, balls and strikes are going to be argued to the end of time, like we said.
It that's an American tradition unlike any other. Sorry,
it's more American than baseball, the sport.
It is, exactly.
It is just, it's going to happen, right? But you just can't lose your cool. I mean, if it's been done for the whole time, we have seen hundreds, thousands of players, coaches, whatever, see them, the repercussions, grabbing a base, getting thrown out, you know, like we have seen it all. Show your frustration a different way. Go over and slam that Gatorade cooler if you need to, you know.
There's other ways to express that.
You're right, yeah. You need to break a bat. Cool. I understand. I would not view that as bad, but don't take it out on the refs or the umps. It's just
because they're the ones that are they're holding the eject button, and they can press that magic red button and get you tossed from this game.
Right. And even if his intent was not to mess you up, you know, today or tomorrow, his intent was to get you out before you did something worse, right?
Yep. Every time.
Yeah.
That's why they warn them. That's why they warn them. They don't want to toss these kids. They really don't. Yes, like, they can be incompetent at their jobs, but they don't want to be known as the person that tosses an important player without warning.
Yeah, if you do it without warning, then it's a complete – then we're talking about something completely different.
Then the blame is shifting completely. Right.
Then it would be more on the ump being like he maybe had an intent out for him to take him out.
Exactly.
Okay, you see that part. But I don't think that part was there. I definitely don't. I think that he reacted to the low strike call that clearly is a ball.
Was at his shins, yeah.
Yep. But you can't lose your cool in that situation, especially with so much on the line. You've had a great season. Like, it shouldn't end like this, especially if you're hosting a regional. I mean, it doesn't happen. It just doesn't happen every day in Tennessee.
No, it is that special. Yeah,
yes, more
exactly.
Frequently. Tennessee Vols, not so much.
That's what makes this season so special. We have text on our text line driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. We'll read those on the other side. Feel free to chime in, 615-737-1025. More Campbell and Knezovic talking Vol baseball coming up next here on ESPN 102.5, 106.3 The Game, and The Game Nashville app. Now remember, you can listen to the show on the terrestrial airwaves, but you can also watch us streaming live on Twitch, Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook, live every day, not just this show. Robbie and Rex Road, Darren Donick and Chase, Stillman and Company with Caroline Fenton. All of our video streaming is brought to you by the law offices of Amanda Gentry. Now, I'm Elijah Campbell. He's Jared Cassidy. And we're talking about this historic Vols baseball team. And if maybe what Drew Gilbert did to get himself tossed last night in their 8-6 game one loss to Notre Dame, if there are some parallels to Draymond Green getting tossed in the 2016 NBA Finals and costing his team a chance to cap off a historic regular season with the one thing that everybody wants. That's the title. Will from Nashville on our text line, driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. Text in says, 100% agree with you on this Gilbert thing, and I'm sorry the culture that exists on this team, in my opinion, likely contributed to that player's reaction. And then he goes on to say that it doesn't mean they still can't win it all, of course. And of course, it doesn't mean they still can't win it all. They can still come back and win this game today. Dolander can shut them out on the mound, and they don't need to score 10 runs to win this game. And then Drew Gilbert comes back in game three and hit three home runs, and they go to Omaha, and then they can still run the table from there, almost like nothing ever happened. But it's going to be harder to do that without their best player. And the part of that text that I really zoned in on is that the culture existing on this team likely contributed to the player's reaction. And I don't want the discussion about Tennessee's culture the way it is right now to be necessarily a bad thing, because that's what got them here, right?
100%.
Yeah, like that's the edge that they've played with all season long that has gotten them to a position to be a team that wins 56 games and only loses 7. They play with an edge, a swagger, and a cockiness that is very warranted because they are that good. They know they're that good, and they're going to tell you they're that good. And if they're going to win the game on the field, they're going to win the game between the ears. But part of winning the game between the ears is finding that line between your brash, cockiness, swagger that makes you, but keeping it within the lines of keeping your players in the game. Because if your best players aren't in the game, it's going to be harder for you to win. It's a common sense thing. You just got to be able to find that line and toe it and not cross it. And that line was crossed yesterday. And if that is the same thing that continues to happen, it doesn't matter how good you are, but if you can't keep it all together, then the result yesterday can become more of a norm.
Right. Yeah, we could see it more frequently, depending on the mood and how things go today. Obviously, if they lose today, there's no tomorrow. So, but if you win today, then you live to fight another day.
And with your best player back, with Drew Gilbert
right.
back. Yeah.
Right, which could help you. But also, too, some of your best arms have already gone. Especially, too, if tonight gets into, like, a bullpen scenario where, you know, you need a lot of arms coming in and out, tomorrow could look more bleak than does today.
It really could. And, obviously, it's do or die for the Vols today. You lose today, season's over. But you have Chase Dolander on the mound, the SEC pitcher of the year, and that's significant. You're going to have him be not just the SEC pitcher of the year. You need him to be the college baseball pitcher of the year today because you lose a big bat. And you can go home early if you're giving up 5 runs in the first few innings. You can't get off to that kind of start and expect to win every single game. You got to be able to get that from your arms. And it would go down significantly as a not just a Vol baseball blunder, but an all-time University of Tennessee sports blunder, which we have come accustomed to in this state of watching the University of Tennessee not be able to get out of their own way on many occasions in many sports, whether it's Rick Barnes not being able to win a game in March whenever the NCAA tournament rolls around, or maybe it's not being able to keep a football coach for more than 4 or 5 years because they all get run out of town or boycotting hires or doing whatever, and the football team being the mess that it's been in the last 2 decades, this university has had a hard time athletically staying out of their own way at times. And boy, wouldn't that be on brand for them to not even make Omaha because one of their best players couldn't keep from F-bombing and dog-cussing an umpire.
Man, I've been living this heart attack my whole life.
You and me both, brother. Me and me both. I've been living in the state, loved yeah. University of Tennessee athletics.
Love it.
And at this point, it's like, okay, of course that's how this ends. Of yep. course a 56-7 regular season and playoff run is going to end because of that kind of ejection. Of course that would be how it happens.
It would like just be pulling a Tennessee, man. I mean, it is. It's sad. It really mm-hmm. is. That's why, if you're asking me, I don't think they lose today. I don't. I think after tomorrow. I understand.
They can't go down like
right.
that.
Man. I just don't think Tony was going to sit there and let them go out like that. It's such a bad look for him, too. But, I mean, if they do, it is, like you said, it is up there with the biggest collapses in Tennessee sports yeah. all around.
And then it hurts for this program, too, that they have turned – and they've gotten better every year, right? Like, you could see the progression right. under Tony Vitello where they got out of the cellar in the SEC to not just become relevant players, but to being the schoolyard bully now. Like, you've gotten to where you were being picked on. You are now doing the picking on of other schools because you have gotten that good. Like, that's the thing about, like, this program was built in honestly a really cool way. It was a program in which Tony Vitello did an incredible job of building it bit by bit. I don't want to say brick by brick because those are bad words around here, especially for you, for Tennessee Vol fans. But they got a little better each year. They finally broke on through the barrier to get to Omaha. And the next step is like winning games in Omaha. And then you watch this team become this dominant, be the number one team all season long, being the best team in college baseball all season long by a country mile. And then for it to not even get to the point where you were last season feels like regression.
Yeah, it could be very rough. Last night felt like a weird game. Obviously, the flow to it was, you know, halted because of that. But it just seems like, you know, we've seen Tennessee even in the Campbell series, the Campbell fighting Camels.
The Campbell fighting Camels.
Yeah. Which was great. I mean, I texted you during that game and said, man, could this go a different way than what we thought? Mm-hmm. And they were up. And then what happened? Tennessee came back. So I think a lot of us last night, too, even with Drew Gilbert being gone, I think a lot of us really felt like, man, they could do it. And they started to. And they were down 2 in the eighth inning and just couldn't get it going. Maybe if Drew's there, maybe they bust through a couple of runs there somehow. Maybe manufacture them. Maybe somebody hits a big home run, drive someone in. You never know. But with him being tossed by things that he can control and that we as humans can control. Yeah.
Yeah. You can control that.
Right. And I understand that situations you're going to lose your cool. It happens to everybody, professional or amateur. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But it's when you contain those and keep it in. And there's a time and place for it to be let out. Like we said, the dugout. Or if you really need to.
It won't get you tossed.
Yeah.
You know?
If you really need to, just hold it in at the end. Walk in that locker room. Slam a locker, man. I've done it too.
exactly.
I played high school sports. It's not on. I'm not comparing it to that at all. I'm just saying I've been in the situation where you do something to yourself, especially as a golfer, where it's, you know, it's you. It's an individual sport. That's where I feel it the most. Where it you are 100% the
blame. You are your team. The team is everything. But right. you between the years. Yes.
Right. And when you do something last night like that, you are saying that it's almost like you're saying that you're bigger than that. Like, hey, you should have given me that. That was definitely not a strike. Well, yeah, mm-hmm. we all saw that. That guy saw it. Even the ref, the ump probably saw it. But he made that call. You got to keep your cool during that moment.
Man, it's funny because I know high school basketball, college baseball, obviously they're apples and oranges. And I don't want to compare my limited sporting career to this, but like, we had a coach every game. He was the statistician, not even technically a coach. every single one of the coaches on our coaching staff before each game would give the specific spiel, whether it's trying to motivate us or it's a tactical speech. It's here's what we're going to do and this is how we're going to attack the game, yada, yada, yada. But our statistician, Coach Brian Hill, love him to death, would always – It's almost like he would verbally copy and paste for every game, same way. The officials are going to make bad calls. I know they're going to make bad calls. I know this officiating crew, even though I don't know if he knew all of them or not. He'd say that he knew them. They're going to make bad calls. But you can't get flustered. And he used the word flustered. You can't get flustered. Every single time before we went out on the floor, Coach Brian Hill would tell us not to get flustered. And it's the same thing. It's like, because we didn't play with like a Tennessee baseball kind of edge, but like, there's some of us on our team that had a little bit of an attitude that had a tendency to get teed up. And Brian Hill would be damned if we got caught, if we cost our own team a chance to win a game because we were getting teed up and maybe tossed, who knows. So like, somebody has to be an adult in the room and say, listen, we play with an edge that we have, and that's what makes us really good. But you got to be able to keep it together. If it's somebody delivering that message, or maybe it's like Will Ferrell in Old School where he's burned from totally botching the Ring of Fire stunt and he's in the locker room yelling at everybody to keep their composure ironically, somebody's got to do it. Somebody's got to do it because you can't win these games without your best players, and it could cost Tennessee. We'll continue the conversation in the second hour as we approach this little halftime part of Kamblin Knezevic. We have more Tennessee baseball, Titans offseason, a big game in the NHL, and Jared Cassidy is our golf expert. And the world of golf has gotten very strange and interesting.
It's fiery right now for sure.
It's dramatic, and we'll get to that as well in the second hour of Kamblin Knezevic right here on ESPN 102.5, 106.3, The Game, and The Game Nashville app. Hour number two, Kamblin Knezevic here, ESPN 102.5, 106.3, The Game. I'm Elijah Campbell. No Michelle today, but our man, resident Boston Celtics fan and expert, Jared Cassidy, also known as Papa Cass around these parts, behind the board and behind the mic for today. 1 hour down, one to go. Tease it before the break, because here's the thing about Jared. Jared does not get to spiel his golf takes. It doesn't have what he says a platform adequate enough to get away his golf takes. And what better week to have some golf takes than this one with the Saudi Arabian funded Live League? I know it's the Live Golf Tour. Or
so there are a couple of things that are being thrown out. One, they're saying Live Golf because they're saying that they want to be different than the PGA Tour, but mm-hmm. It's actually the Roman numerals 5 and 5 and 4. Meaning, okay. 54 holes is what they're playing, which is like a 3-day event. Normal PGAs are like 4-day events, unless Ryder Cup can vary, stuff like that. But typical, right. Like this weekend, they started Thursday, they'll end Sunday afternoon. But the golf Twitter, first of all, it's not chaotic. Like
golf Twitter and vol Twitter don't necessarily exist right. In the same realm of intensity.
Yeah. It's like Jupiter and Mars. It's just like two different places. So with that being said, you know, golf is the gentleman's game. Well, their stuff has just been flying for the last couple of days. I mean, really for the last couple of weeks and months. But we knew that eventually that this, you know, tour would come up and that once they started, things were going to get out of hand. So Jay Monahan, who is the president of the PGA of America, and has been doing this for a couple of years, came out with a statement right before the PGA players teed off on Thursday afternoon, saying that if any player defected to the Live Golf Tour, that they would be temporarily suspended from any events. Now, they can still play in the majors. So for those that don't know, 4 golf majors a year, the Open, the U.S. Open, the Masters, and
the PGA Championship,
which we just had. So you can still play in those, so which means Dustin Johnson, Phil Mickelson, these players that have abandoned the PGA Tour to go to this Live Golf Tour.
Which has gotten a murderer's row of a lineup to be able to join it.
And it is backed by Saudi money. So there again, there's a black cloud above that.
The Phil Mickelson comments about it are bizarre.
I don't know if you saw that when they asked him if he wanted to say a statement about the PGA, he said, I'm not making a statement at this time, basically just shutting everything down.
Somebody told him to shut the hell up.
Yeah,
because he's digging his own grave.
This whole thing is crazy because they've had – so Greg Norman is in charge of this, right? He is one of these main brains behind this. If you don't know Greg Norman, there's a ESPN 30 for 30 on him. You should go watch mm-hmm. that. It will give you a little bit more on why he is doing this. Greg Norman has been salty at the PGA for a very long time for reasons that are self-inflicted by him.
A lot of his reasons for his gripes in his professional career are self-inflicted.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that he's not a good golfer, that he's not a good person. I'm not saying that at all. But he has started this to rival the PGA Tour. That is 100% what they are doing. It is not, I've seen a lot, like I just told you at the break, I've seen a lot of people saying that this is like the NBA and the NBA G League. This is...
That's a laughable notion.
That is Spanish to English. Like, it is completely different. Because in the NBA, they would pull from those teams in the G League.
Yeah. The development league. Yes. Yeah, the G League is not pulling LeBron James to play in the G League.
Yeah, this is not that at all.
For the LA Defenders.
Yeah, they are trying to go one-on-one with them, mano a mano, league versus league. And they are trying to pull as many players as they have, and they have pulled some top-name players. Now, the other side of this is that some of these top-name players that they have pulled away from the PGA Tour are not necessarily in the greatest place with the PGA Tour right now. So, Phil Mickelson, if you don't know, you need to find out. He's had a little bit of a tough couple of months. Has not played in the Masters, sent a little message the first day. I don't know if you saw this, Elijah. He wore a Augusta National insignia on his vest at day one on the LIV Tour.
Oh, wow.
Just a little jab, a little poke the bear kind of to Jay Monahan, I feel like, too.
A little subtlety.
A little Augusta National. But this whole thing is, it's kind of wild. They're pulling these people, like I said. They pulled Dustin Johnson. He was at one time the world number one ranked golfer. He has won multiple majors. He is in contention on a average week-to-week basis. He is a big player.
Yes.
They have pulled him. Dustin Johnson, in my eyes, now this is just me, and I'm just a guy, right? He is 100% chasing the money.
Oh, yeah.
As all of these players are.
Mm-hmm. Because like they're like the bag that's being opened for them to make a whole lot more money and participate in a many fewer events.
Yeah, you will not make that money on the PGA Tour, even if your name is Eldrick Tiger Woods. You're just not. Like, he doesn't even make that money on these tournaments. And just another little side note, Greg Norman offered him $1 billion. That is with a B, not
Whoa,
an M.
Oh, boy.
That is with a B. That is a billion. Otherwise known as a lot of money.
That's a lot of Benjis.
Yeah. Would not have to do anything, could play whenever he wants, which is basically what he's doing already on the PGA Tour.
It is, yeah.
And I don't see him playing a lot of these events like that. I don't see him ever going to that. The other name that's been thrown out and who just announced yesterday is Bryson DeChambeau. So Bryson DeChambeau, we all know, kind of this people thought he was hot shot, going to be the next big thing, change golf. He has not. It has not been sustainable for him. He has then had a wrist surgery and is kind of working his way back. His PR has taken a little bit of a hit, too. Also, with the whole Brooks Koepka thing, seeing if they're going to fight or not.
He's already a polarizing figure in the sport.
Right. So he has now left to go to the LIV, so he will not be playing in any other PGA tournaments. He will most likely... I can assume that most of these players, unless they just can't or don't, because the other thing with the majors is you either have to have won them or qualify within certain parameters from each of these different majors. So it's going to vary from player to player. It's not like just a broad thing.
And it's from tournament to tournament too. Wouldn't it be, because I know like the U.S. Open is an open invitational. Like amateurs can participate.
Correct.
If you reach certain parameters. And I think that's the only one I really know of that we could guarantee that LIV golfers can participate in, as far as I know.
Yeah, so it should be that, and it should be the Open, too, because the Open follows a different set of rules as well,
yeah.
Because they can invite anybody from the European continents that they choose, basically.
Yeah.
the U.S. Open, like you said, is open to amateur players as well, so anybody can get in. The PGA Championship is open to all PGA players. It is also open to past champions, and if you are a teaching professional, so that is like your local golf course, if you qualify,
pro,
yes. Yeah. The whole thing with these tournaments is you have to do the Monday qualifiers. Well, this LIV thing could cause another wrench into the system too, because what if they're playing and they're over in somewhere else? Like right now they're in London. It's really not that far of a flight. You go somewhere else, you go down to Australia, you're, you know, Japan, these areas, you're going to start getting into a lot of these flights being a problem.
Mm-hmm. And that's where it's going to get sticky for that. And then the Masters is also a huge question mark, because Augusta National plays by their own rules, right?
Like
100%. It is its own place
within a city. That place is a fortress. It is the holy field of golf.
Yes.
You are there. If you're there, you're there for a reason. You're not just walking by randomly on a Tuesday.
Exactly. It's a little too pristine for that.
Yeah. So some more players too. Patrick Reed. I know we talked about him too. A lot of people do not like Patrick Reed. He is kind of brash. He has a very cockiness attitude towards everybody. And on the tour, he is 100% chasing the money. And
that's the moral dilemma, though, too, because like Phil Mickelson, I think, laid it out really well, where he, like, honestly, it was pure truth serum. Like, he was just stream of consciousness speaking, where it's like, yeah, these guys like that are giving me this money, like, have killed journalists. They are scary, scary people. This money is not the cleanest thing on the planet. But yeah, I'm taking it because I'm in a lot of debt. He's got a lot of debt that he's having to take care of. And like the allure for a lot of these players that are never going to make this money or see anything close to this kind of money on the PGA Tour, they're going to get a whole lot more of it and participate in less events. Like the draw there is so enticing that it does like create this moral dilemma for a lot of golfers that haven't like made it yet. Like your Patrick Reeds, who have tasted success, but are a big enough name for this tour to want them. But also it's like hard to, it's hard for them to turn that down, you know? So I get the dilemma that a lot of these golfers are facing in terms of choosing whether or whether or not to take that money and be a part of this.
Right. And it's also putting a lot of these players that play on the PGA Tour right now currently in a rough spot too, because a lot of these players, you know, they see them on a daily, if not weekly basis.
Yeah.
So these guys talk, you know, they're going to, and the first thing that's going to happen is when they come over, when these LIV players come over to play in a major and they can talk to these other players that are playing in it from the PGA, mm-hmm. that's when we could see things get a little bit more spicy as well. But it's just, it's kind of crazy that they're trying to do this. They're trying to rival against it, and they're trying to cause chaos because they want it to be more of a free agency for these players, saying that they can play in any place that they want to. Well, the only problem with that is that you only have two places right now, the newly created LIV
yep.
Tour and the PGA, which has sustained for a long time. Like, it's been around for a while, guys.
It's operated as a monopoly.
Right. And that's what Greg Norman said in his thing. It was that they, to Jay Monahan, basically, once he said his comments, he said it, that you're forming a monopoly on golf, which is not what we want to do. LIV Tour is also saying that they are trying to grow the game. Well, yeah, you are growing the game by creating different opportunities for people that wouldn't necessarily get this chance to make this amount of money. But at the same time, you are doing more damage by dividing these players with people that they've played with for years and years. Mm-hmm. The PGA is the best place to play golf. I will say that forever. It is.
Yeah.
You know, we travel all over the world. I say we, like I am one of them. they travel yeah. all over the world to all these different places that didn't have golf, that have had golf. That the game of golf is growing at an exponential rate, which is great. All these young players
yeah.
coming up. Something like this could possibly derail this. And it's not going to be like 2 months from now. It could be years from now that we could see these repercussions.
And I have one main concern with the formation of the LIV Golf Tour. It's my biggest one that I have, and we'll discuss that conversation, my concern on the other side, as you're listening to Kamel Knezevic right here on ESPN 102.5, 106.3 The Game, The Game Nashville app. To take the money, or not to take the money, the LIV Golf Tour is going to drastically change professional golf, how it's viewed. Because I don't think they have a major TV streaming or not streaming that because they're streaming things on YouTube right now.
Right.
They don't have a direct TV media rights deal in place.
To my knowledge, they're on just on YouTube and Twitter spaces, social media spaces is what I've gathered.
Which is odd. And that's the way sports media is going to. I mean, there's a direction in sports media where a lot of it's going to be streaming, and maybe you can punt on spending big money for TV rights and TV contracts to be able to just stream your own product on a service like YouTube. But my biggest – I have one main concern about this tour, and if the PGA is steadfast on not allowing a lot of their players to participate in PGA-sanctioned events, and that might be of cheapening some of the products that we've grown to love in the PGA Tour, right? Like the four majors that you alluded to in the last segment, Jared, we discussed that these guys can – realistically play in the U.S. Open and the Open, the artist formerly known as the British Open, to participate in those because they're open invitationals. PGA Championship, I think we can agree, is probably off the table if this ban or suspension, whatever it is still in place by the time the PGA Championship rolls around next season. And then there's the Masters. It's the Super Bowl of golf, the Holy Grail, whatever you want to use to describe the Masters. I think most people would agree, casual golf fans and avid golf fans and lovers, that the Masters is the most important event on the golf calendar. And Augusta National is in a tough spot to have to, because they create their own rules anyway. They live by their own rules. The Masters is a unique tournament because of that element. However, if they decide not to take them, some of the biggest names in golf won't be able to participate on the game's biggest stage. And I think that could potentially do irreparable harm to the product itself.
Yes. So this year was a big kind of wake-up call, I guess, for Augusta National, because once the whole Phil Mickelson drama started and you kind of, the writing was on the wall that he was not going to play, then it kind of just became, they kind of tried to sweep it under the rug, like, hey, he's not here, but it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that works, but they really got put in a bad situation with the PGA Championship because Phil won that last year. And so he is the current champion up until this last one. So with him being gone, that sets a real bad example that your current champion is no longer there for reasons that he did to himself, which we've said that, and he's in that rough spot. But it can do really big damage for here going forward, especially with Augusta National, because like you said, they control everything. They have a, I mean, for gosh sakes, they have a lottery system for average people that I have been in my entire adult life to try to win tickets. I have been to Augusta, but I have not been inside with that ticket from them with the winning lottery numbers on.
It's like the golden ticket in Willy Wonka.
Right. Like you are not, like very few people get that opportunity. And like I said, I submit for it every year. So if they are that particular on who they let in by that, then I don't even want to know what's going to happen once these live events keep going, because this week that's going on right now is the first one. This is the inaugural event for them. So who's to know if in 6 months, I mean, if it's going to be up and going. The only thing that makes me think that it is still going to go is that it's backed by money, and that money doesn't stop. And so if the money doesn't stop and you can keep bringing in people in, doesn't really matter about the product, because as golfers, they're going to want to watch. I mean, some people are going to want to watch them. Like some people love Phil Mickelson, right? So some people are going to watch him just because it's Phil.
It's Phil. He's got a fan following.
Right. Yeah. Whereas somebody like myself, who just loves golf in general and who consumes golf at a large amount, content on my phone, internet, whatever, this, it's going to constantly put something out there for players to look at. But when you have two competing same identities going at each other, it's going to cause friction. And a lot of these players that are defecting to the LIV Tour will inevitably not play on the PGA Tour events and could lead to them not possibly playing in majors, which is, if you're a golfer at any level, like me as an amateur golfer, I would love to win a major. But I know that that is never going to happen. But these players,
be a long shot.
Exactly. But these players have that opportunity to win because they play on the PGA Tour. So they have that. Now that they don't have that opportunity, I don't know what's going to happen. And as of right now, they've announced that they can play in the majors. But that's as of Thursday when this thing kicked off.
This thing could change dramatically.
Right. Yes. So in the coming months, we're going to see more and more things come out on how they're going to process all this. Also, we're going to have the Open, which is like 5 weeks away, 4 weeks away, I think. So not very much longer. And that's coming around the corner. And they would love for some of those players to play in them. But I'm sure that they don't want that drama to come with them right now.
Exactly. And there's one thing that you mentioned too that I find really interesting is like how much the viewership would change for the Masters, because a lot of people are going to watch it because they are avid golf fans. Those are your A1 since day one support groups that they love the product. The Masters is their favorite sporting event of the year. They're going to watch it if Tiger Woods and Phil Mickelson are in a pairing, or they're going to watch it if me and you are out there and I'm shanking everything into the woods and I'm out there just playing around. Like like people are going to watch the Masters because it is the Masters, but how much does maybe not having that kind of star power attract like the casual fan too? I wonder how big that number is going to be, because it's going to be a number. It's going to be something that we can be able to detect and be able to tangibilize, I guess, be able to put in a number.
Right.
And how big is that going to be, though, if you don't have, which if Tiger Woods was going to took the offer to go play on the LIV Tour, then I think that number is significant. But if Tiger is going to participate like in the Masters every year, then I think you can still salvage a large part of that audience.
Yeah. And Augusta does a great job too with their app as far as like being able to watch everything, because they own the rights to it. So they have the deal with ESPN. So obviously we know that the first two rounds are on ESPN. Well, then ESPN Plus, since that's been going and they have that deal with them now, you can pretty much watch it at any time. Well, you can always watch it on their app. Mm-hmm. You can do your own players. So like Augusta National does a great job with that as far as making their media stuff accessible to the average viewers. I mean, even if somebody knows that the Masters and then they see it and then they're like, oh, you know, let me give this a shot, let me look at it. It's just so user-friendly that they're going to get those people. But I think we will see a big drop-off in people just because some of these big-name players like Dustin Johnson, Phil Mickelson, Bryson DeChambeau, Patrick Reed, Pat Perez, if you're familiar with him, his mm-hmm. wife put out yesterday night that he is leaving the PGA Tour to go to LIV Golf. So she's trying to get in. They're trying to get into the scoops business, I guess. But as more and more of these players go, we could see more backlash from the PGA with more, because right now it just says that they're suspended. It doesn't say suspended for a year. It doesn't say suspended for 6 weeks. It doesn't say any kind of lettering like that, to my knowledge, that I've seen on Twitter. But that could change at a drop of a hat. We could see them come down next week and they could say, hey, we are not letting them in at all. I don't think that that's going to happen because there's huge names right there. I mean, Dustin Johnson is one of the biggest.
And not allowing those names to play in those tournaments is pretty significant, because I think the PGA is going to get some of the viewing numbers and they're going to be able to really be able to look at the damage that's done. And I think it's going to be significant enough where they might at least have to rethink that stance.
Yeah. And it could hurt them. And that's why this is kind of a wild, unforeseen place. I mean, something like this has never happened.
Yeah. You know, in any professional sport, there's no precedent for this.
Right. And like for the thing back to earlier when I compared it to when somebody compared it to the G League, that kind of already exists. It has for a long time. It was called the web.com tour. Now it's called the Corn Ferry Tour. They play in Nashville every year.
Yeah.
So if you're not familiar with it, you should get familiar with it. But that's what they do. That is the development league, basically, the development tour for the PGA. And there's another
league. System.
Right. Yeah. There's also amateur leagues that, you know, like there's all these opportunities. But the LIV Golf is to strictly serve one purpose, and that is to rival the PGA Tour, steal as many players as they can, pay them this absurd amount of money, and let them play. I don't know what the playing percentage is, because they're only playing 54 holes instead of 72. So, I mean, you're taking a day off of each week, but I also don't know. Are they going to play every week? Are they going to play every other week? how is the field? They do a different format. They do team formats, whereas the PGA Tour is typically stroke play, occasional match play thrown in with the Dell Technologies Opens. So many things could happen, but it's just way too early to tell.
Mm-hmm.
But things have just been chaotic since this LIV Tour kicked off.
It has. And I think I might have made it not been correct. I said there's no precedent because the NFL and the USFL kind of, like, the USFL tried to coexist, because at first it was like it was the spring league, and then they were taking some players from the NFL or trying to, and making it a direct competitor. And then, of course, some leadership in the USFL tried to compete in the fall and compete directly with the NFL in the fall, and it got squashed. They didn't have the funding the NFL had. They didn't have the backing and the viewership that the NFL would have. So it got squashed and ended up dying, and the USFL wasn't a sustainable product because of that. And, of course, other leagues have tried to pop up. The XFL was a niche thing for a long time, and they tried to bring it up again before the pandemic. And, of course, the pandemic killed the modern rendition of the XFL. So there's, like, I guess, other precedents in professional sports, but none of which were taking the biggest names and the biggest players in being able to force the hand of the other. The NFL never had their hand forced when it came to a rival league, because they knew they could squash them. This isn't a squashable thing for the PGA. I think that's what makes this really interesting.
Yeah, and they're going to have to try to contain it and try to retain as many great players that they have on the PGA Tour. Like, Justin Thomas has been in the media here lately about being very outspoken about it, you know, saying, like, I'm not going to do that. The PGA Tour is the best place to play golf. And it is. Mm-hmm. Hands down, it is. I mean, one, this is a complete different format. It's not necessarily an individual scoring. It is, but it's not. Whereas golf is an individual sport. That is the foundation of this sport. That is forever. It is an individual sport. You go out there by yourself. Also, another thing is, you know, with this money, like I said, the fact that the money is so big behind this, that the money, it's almost like it's too big to fail, I feel like.
Yeah.
But it could. It totally could. They could run stagnant by getting players, by getting good, high-quality players. They could just be getting the average player on the PGA Tour that maybe makes a cut every couple of months. And if that starts to happen, then the product's out there, then people aren't going to go, and the people are not going to spend money. And then what happens when you don't spend money? It fails.
You don't make money, and then you can't pay the massive contracts, right, that you're giving
that
out
to
these players.
That you promised these people.
Exactly. Which is something another league ran into. There's a good text on our text line we'll get to on the other side. It's a good point, but it also proves my point from earlier. We'll get to that on the other side. Listen to Campbell and Knezovic right here on ESPN 102.5, 106.3 The Game, and the Game Nashville app. You can always text in or call in our phone lines, which are driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com at 615-737-1025. Campbell and Knezovic, which today is Campbell and Cassidy. Our man Jared filling in for Michelle. And Bo and Murfreesboro on our text line did say that there are precedents in place, because I did say there isn't much of a precedence earlier, which wasn't exactly true. In certain areas. He later goes on and says, the ABA to the NBA, NFL, the AFL, it's simply capitalism. You don't have to like it, but that's what it is, which is very true. The ABA was able to take some players, Rick Barry being notably one of them, who was already a really good player in the NBA, and they were able to get him to switch leagues. The ABA was able to get guys like Dr. J, coming out of college. They didn't steal him from the NBA, but they offered him a lot of money to take it. They promised him that he would make more money playing for the Virginia Squires than he would of taking an NBA contract after getting drafted in the NBA. The NBA and ABA were drafting the same players, and players were having to decide which contracts they would actually sign. But the biggest thing here, in terms of where it might not be an apples to apples comparison, Bo, is that the ABA failed because the ABA had no money. They were writing checks that they couldn't cash. You know, they were writing these astronomical contracts at the time, millions and millions of dollars, which were unprecedented in pro sports at the time, and they couldn't follow up with it because they weren't generating a lot of money at the gate. The Virginia Squires fell on their face. There's that team. They might have had, I think, three or four teams And if you've never like understood the history of the ABA, I highly recommend reading the book Loose Balls by Terry Pluto, in which it is basically an oral history of the ABA from everybody that was involved in it. People that worked directly with George Mikan, who was the first commissioner of the ABA. You know, like it was a gimmicky league, which was ended up being really influential and ended up changing the game of basketball, and was a very minor competitor to the NBA, because while they were still able to steal some of the players, they were making peanuts compared to what the NBA was making. And that's why it folded after the amount of time it did. Not every team was the Kentucky Colonels. Not every team was the Denver Nuggets, the San Antonio Spurs, the Indiana Pacers, the teams that would eventually go on to play in the NBA as part of the merger. There's a reason only four teams survived the folding of the ABA, and that's because they just weren't making money. The Carolina Cougars didn't have a home court for about 2 years of their existence, where they would have to split games because they couldn't afford to have one simple arena for all of their events. I think the biggest difference between a lot of those competitor leagues, the ABA might have gotten the closest to Bo's point, because they were able to steal stars and get some of them before going to the NBA. You can argue that Artis Gilmore is the greatest ABA player to ever play, and he could have put up numbers in the NBA the same way he did in the ABA, but the Kentucky Colonels were able to outbid for him. However, a lot of those teams, like I said, wrote those massive checks that never got cashed. They failed on promises, defaulted on a lot of stuff, and the league folded like a chair at a picnic table. Like it folded pretty quickly. This LIV Golf Tour, I think, has the funding. I think they're good for their money. You know, for a lot of these offers that are being doled out to these players right now, I feel like they're going to see, those players are going to see that money. Some of those ABA players never saw that money. Never. They signed those contracts, and those contracts were violated by those teams in that league. So while I agree with Bo that, yeah, the ABA actually was probably the closest we've seen to busting a pro sports monopoly, you still have to compete with the big boys in those pro sports leagues. And at the end of the day, while they were still able to get four teams in a merger, and able to salvage some money for some of the owners for TV rights, that they didn't go out to succeed the way a lot of these leagues try to set out to succeed to be legitimate competitors. I feel like this, if the LIV Golf Tour really wants to continue, I think they will at least not run into the same problems the USFL had and the ABA had in terms of just being able to actually cash the checks they write.
Yeah, for sure. The money is the thing behind this that kind of throws the wrench into the system. Mm-hmm. Because obviously the players are chasing money, and they can say whatever they want. The whole thing on golf Twitter has been like, you know, a lot of these players are coming out with one or two pages of stuff that's basically fancy words and letters on there that's saying, "I'm taking the money."
So yes, to summarize.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes, even the SparkNotes version.
Like reading Phil's letter, you know, he was like, "I've played on the PGA for X amount of years. It's the thing that I love the most, but I love golf, and this has given me a platform to do that." And that's fine, Phil. You can say all that, but your reason is different, is not much different from Dustin Johnson.
Exactly.
Dustin Johnson's set. So is Phil. So is majority of these PGA players that play on a week-to-week basis on the tournament. You know, you're going to get your ones and twos that are going to come in there from the middle of nowhere, like John Daly. When he got that invitation to Crooked Stick, like, he was the alternate. It took somebody withdrawing from that tournament for him to even get into that tournament, and he came in and won the whole thing. So, like, you're going to get those kind of deals to where, you know, that person's, like, he wasn't making a large amount of money, but after that, he was making a large amount of money. So these players are going to see that, and the money is good for it. So the other thing is that I think this is just pure speculation. I think that at some point, Jay Monahan is going to come out, the governing body of the PGA is going to come out with some kind of incredibly harsh punishment, like a lifetime ban on any PGA tour, any events or anything, to try to shut down this other league. Because their hands already basically played, like they've lost, and not like top 10 talent right now. I'll give you that. We had a texter, not top 10, But definitely, these are bigger names. These are
names
not
that are going to draw the casual fan. And that's really what the war is over. In terms of if you're going to have a competitive league, the diehards are going to be stay true to the brand. They're going to stay true to the people who maybe are the best golfers on the planet right now. But to the casual fan, the name is more significant than what they actually bring to the table right now. Like Tiger Woods isn't a top 20 golfer right now. Probably not even top 50, top 100, whatever. Tiger Woods isn't what Tiger Woods was, but Tiger Woods is still Eldrick Tiger Woods, and people will still pay out the ass to watch him. If there's a way to watch him play golf, people are going to watch him play golf just because he's Tiger Woods.
Right, and he moves the needle like
And I'm one of those people.
Right, yeah, me too. So, I mean, like, the LIV Tour is not going after the the person like myself that watches golf on a everyday to weekly basis. Mm-hmm. They're going for the casual person that's like, hey, there's nothing on Sunday at 2 o'clock right now. You know, whatever. Let me flip on the channel. Oh, cool, golf. That's who they're trying to draw. They're trying to draw the person that's different. They're also on, you know, like I said, right now they're in London. Not many PGA stops are in London.
That's
true. On the European tour, or the DP tour now that it's called, you will have stops like that in London, you know, wherever. Amsterdam, they stop all over. But the PGA, you know, for the majority stays in the United States, except for the times when they go to, like, you know, Dubai. Like, the Dubai series is good. That's always a fun one. But these players are jumping ship from the PGA because of the money. They're going over there to play in this different format. They can tell you whatever they want. But yeah, that's the reasoning behind it. But back to the point of it, you know, being almost too big to fail, I feel as a golf fan that it's almost too big to fail unless, like I said, something big happens to where there's repercussions on if you go. Whereas right now it's pretty lax. You're just suspended. That's all it really says.
It's vague. Like they have the suspension in place, yeah. And now I just feel like they're behind closed doors concocting what the actual punishment's going to be.
Oh, 100%. Jay Monahan is having a fit right now trying to figure out what he needs to do to, A, retain a lot of these players that could, you know, bail out and go somewhere else. But the coming weeks will be hard to tell and will show us a lot, though.
Exactly.
Because this is just the first week of the LIV Tour, so if they can continue to go on this pace and let's say a month, let's revisit this and see what it looks like.
Yeah.
We'll also see how many players are going to leave. We'll also see maybe the PGA comes out with something.
And what the product actually is. This LIV Tour can also just not be great television. Maybe a small golf league, the way it's kind of being pitched as.
Right.
Maybe that doesn't create a great product. Out in theory, maybe it was great in theory. It might just not be good in practice, and then that's how it folds because it doesn't get the support from the consumer, the support from the ownership of the organization itself, which is really the biggest difference between this league and other leagues like the USFL, the AFL, the ABA, where the funding from all the owners wasn't sufficient enough to begin with, and you might have been a little over your head in terms of forecasting what you're going to make to be able to sustain this model. The money from the ownership, we know, is not going to be the problem with the LIV Tour. The problem might just be that it's not a great product, and that's a pretty significant thing as well that could also do it in. So it's going to be interesting, at least for the next month. I guess we can definitely revisit this here and see if it's at least a good product, B, a sustainable one, and see whether or not the theory of this being the closest thing we get to busting a monopolized professional sport actually coming to fruition can still be done. We'll definitely know more as time goes on, but it's a great discussion to be had. One more segment to go on the show. Of course, it's time to give you some picks. Time to make you some money on this loaded sports weekend coming up next here on Campbell and Knezovic right here on ESPN 102.5, 106.3, The Game and The Game Nashville app. All right, final segment here on Campbell and Knezovic, which today, of course, is Campbell and Cassidy. Papa Jared Cassidy behind the glass, spinning the tunes, as well as chiming in on the discussion. But it's time for the last segment of the show. So, I mean, as is tradition, we're going to make some picks here on Campbell and Knezovic, as we always do. And I think a good place to start the game tonight, Rangers, Tampa Bay Lightning. which we didn't get to because I thought the LIV golf tour discussion is a really relevant one to have. And I thought, you know, taking that for the whole hour was a good call, but we didn't get to the Rangers and Lightning, and that's wild considering that the Rangers, I thought that was my pick to win the series. I thought they were going to win the conference coming into the playoffs. I felt really good about that. But the Lightning just continue. They won't die, man. They won't die. They do what champions do, and they responded in a big way in coming up with a huge road win, which teams couldn't do much at MSG during these playoffs. The Rangers played fantastic at home, and the Lightning stole one. Now have a chance to close the thing out and be four wins away from a third straight Stanley Cup title.
Just talk about running into a buzzsaw, man. Like, it's just a nonstop gear that's just keep going. It's inevitable, man. The Lightning and the Stanley Cup Finals just seems like it's just repetitive.
Almost predestined at this point.
Which is crazy. It's crazy that we're seeing a stretch that they could possibly get to three straight.
Yeah. Talked about it for an hour on Darren Onick and Chase yesterday, that this is one of the more impressive runs in pro sports because of the NHL's hard salary cap, which is not as flexible as maybe the NFL's or the NBA's. And the amount of different circumstances they had to go to winning one in the bubble, winning one in a shortened season, and a 56-game regular season, and now having a full 82-game regular season, doing all of this after the most embarrassing sweep maybe in pro sports history when they got beat by the Columbus Blue Jackets after winning 66 games. I think it was 60 or 66. But winning 60-plus games in an NHL regular season is a significant feat, and then got swept in humiliating fashion. And then they've responded by winning two straight Stanley Cups on their way to a third. But Game 6 is tonight. It's in Tampa. Man, I think the best bet, because I'm going to pick the Rangers just because I picked them at the beginning of the playoffs. I still feel like this team has enough defensively. I still believe in Shesterkin. It was not Shesterkin's fault. They lost the game. The goal that took the 2-1 lead was a deflection. That's a puck luck bounce that you need to be able to make these runs and win games on the road. So props for Tampa Bay to be able to pull that rabbit out of their hat. But I love this Rangers team. So I'm going to stick with that. Plus 165, that's enough of low odds for me to feel comfortable with going with the dog there, because you can get a significant return. But at plus 120, the under 5 is juicy, because these are the two best goaltenders in the sport. Andrei Vasilevskiy, one of the mainstays on these championship teams, one of the best playoff goaltenders of our lifetime, against the best goalie in the league right now, and Igor Shesterkin, who's going to win the Vezina. I have a feeling this will be a slugfest. The Rangers aren't going down without a fight, but they're not going to be able to do it in a shootout. So I love the under 5 being at plus 120. That's juicy. Under 5 at plus money with the two best goalies in the world? Yes, please.
Yeah, that's some pretty good odds. I would love to see this go the 7, though. I would love to see the Rangers come tonight, win this, take it. I don't know, man. I just see Tampa Bay winning this, but I would lean more towards the under 5 as well. Mm-hmm. I'm
that
with
plus
you.
Plus odds, too.
Yeah. I mean, we've.
Almost feels like a trap, but I'm going to fall for it.
Yeah. If you had to make me parlay them, I would take the Lightning money line, and then I would take the under 5.
And then, of course, NBA on Monday, it is going to be Game 5, Celtics-Warriors. The Warriors have opened up as a 3.5-point favorite. I kind of like the Celtics at plus 3.5. I like, or money line. I say go ahead and take that, because the spread's minus 110, but at plus 135 on the money line, I feel pretty good about the Celtics responding. I do think they're the better team when you line them up. I still think they're the better defensive team. I trust their big man lineup as kind of the kryptonite for the Warriors small ball death lineup, whatever you want to call it. I think the perfect antidote to that is what the Celtics bring defensively, and they're 7-0 in this postseason following a loss, and that's not by accident. So I kind of like the Celtics on the money line in Game 5 on Monday.
Yeah, obviously I'm biased, so let's take that out of it. But the bounce back game for the Celtics is the key point to this for me. I won't say that they got embarrassed, because, I mean, they did lose by 10, but they did kind of claw back at the end. It's just you let Curry score 43 on you. And he just
sometimes
can't do that.
He does that. That's sometimes the great players pull that rabbit out of their hat in that kind of game.
Yep. I got a feeling this goes 3-2 and it heads back to Boston, and I think Boston closes it out on their home court in six. That's how I feel. I would take the plus 3 points. Is that what you said? Plus
three and a half.
So you even get the little hook there. But yeah, I would take that for sure.
And then I don't have any college baseball odds. The sports book of my choice, no free pub here, you got to pay up for that, doesn't have the college baseball lines. But whatever it is, I would take Tennessee on the run line. If the run line's 1.5 against Notre Dame, I would take them on it. As much as I talked about Drew Gilbert losing his cool and it costing them that game and potentially costing them the series because he will not be available for this game as he is suspended, and they're going to be out pitching coach Frank Anderson too for the rest of the series because he's suspended for getting onto the field. It looks like with Dolander on the mound, you have the SEC pitcher of the year. If he can keep the ball in the park, Notre Dame had 4 home runs in the first few innings of that game to give them that 5-1 lead, which is what it was before the ejections happened later on. If you can keep from burying or digging yourself a hole like that, then you're not going to have to rely on just using the Lindsey Nelson launch pad to bail you out of it. If Dolander can keep the ball in the park, I like their chances of winning. I think they do it because they're men on a mission. So take the Vols on the run line today.
Yeah, hate to agree with you just for the sake of it, but yeah, for sure, man. I just don't see a possibility of them losing this with backs against the wall. Tony's going to come in, get a little fire going under him today. Like you said, if they can keep the ball down, I mean, that ball last night, it just seemed like it just carried and carried.
Lindsey Nelson is a launch pad.
Yeah.
It's got a reputation.
And I don't know, just something about this, you know, like we said earlier, they have come back from behind. But when this team jumps out and can get a little bit of a lead and kind of play with that comfortability that, hey, that we are the number one ranked team in the nation, I just don't see them going down the night. I would take the run line for sure.
Absolutely. A lot going on ESPN 102.5, 106.3, the game today. Let's see. Pull up the a great radio as I'm trying to pull up the program.
So we have the Dodgers and the Giants at 11:30. So 30 minutes after this, got a little pregame of
that. That's right.
Then tonight, we have the game that we just previewed. We have the Lightning and the Rangers, game 6. Tampa leads this series 3-2.
And they can close it out tonight. All of that, and of course, you heard it from the man himself, Jay Cass. Dodgers Giants coming up in about 30 minutes. You're listening to Kamala Knezovic right here on ESPN 102.5, 106.3, The Game, The Game Nashville app.